Well, the ongoing mystery of Russia's role in the 2016 U.S. election took an unexpected turn early Saturday morning when President Trump took to Twitter, writing, quote, terrible, just found out that Obama had my wires tapped in Trump Tower just before the victory. Nothing found. This is McCarthyism, unquote.
Trump went on to tweet, how low has President Obama gone to tap, spelled T-A-P-P, to tap my phones during the very sacred election process? This is Nixon Watergate, bad or sick guy, unquote. President Trump offered no evidence, but within 24 hours, he called on lawmakers to probe Obama's actions. On Sunday morning, Trump spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders defended the remarks to host Martha Raddatz on ABC's This Week.
The president of the United States is accusing the former president of wiretapping him.
I think that this is, again, something that if this happened, Martha, I agree.
Why is the president saying it did happen?
Look, I think he is going off of information that he's seen that has led him to believe that this is a very real potential. And if it is, this is the greatest overreach and the greatest abuse of power that I think we've ever seen in a huge attack on democracy itself. And the American people have a right to know if this took place.
It appears the information Trump spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders is referring to is a Breitbart article based on a claim by the far-right wing radio host Mark Levin. On Meet the Press, host Chuck Todd interviewed President Obama's Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper.
I can't speak officially anymore, but I will say that for the part of the national security apparatus that I oversaw as DNI, there was no such wiretap activity mounted against the president-elect at the time, or as a candidate, or against his campaign. I can't speak for other Title III authorized entities in the government, or a state or local entity.
Yeah, I was just going to say, if the FBI, for instance, had a FISA court order of some sort for a surveillance, would that be information you would know or not know?
Yes.
You would be told this.
I would know that.
If there was a FISA court order on something like this.
Something like this, absolutely.
And at this point, you can't confirm or deny whether that exists?
I can deny it.
There is no FISA court order?
Not to my knowledge.
Of anything at Trump Tower?
No.
During the same interview, James Clapper said he's seen no evidence of collusion between members of the Trump campaign and the Russians. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting FBI Director James Comey has asked the Justice Department to publicly reject Trump's assertion that Obama ordered the tapping of Trump's phones. The Times described Comey's request as a, quote, remarkable rebuke of a sitting president, unquote. This all comes just days after Attorney General Jeff Sessions recused himself from any investigation into last year's presidential campaign following reports he met twice with Russia's ambassador to the U.S. while serving as a campaign surrogate for Donald Trump. To make sense of what's happening, we're joined by two guests who will not agree on most anything on this issue. Attorney Scott Horton, lecturer at Columbia Law School, contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and Robert Parry, veteran investigative journalist and editor of the website ConsortiumNews.com, his latest article, The Politics Behind Russiagate. Scott, let's begin with you. Around this FISA order, why does President Trump have to say he's heard reports? Can he pick up the phone and find out?
Absolutely. As commander-in-chief, he would have the right to demand and receive a briefing about anything that's going on. And he would also have the power to declassify and release any information that's been obtained, including FISA court orders, warrants, or other documents. And he's obviously chosen not to do that and instead rely on a Breitbart report of a Mark Levin rant.
And he could declassify.
Absolutely. And release.
Scott, what is your sense of, as this continuing Russia situation has developed over the last several weeks, of what is going on here?
Well, I think the there's growing pressure for a probe of Russian activities in the election within Congress. I think it's gathering support from more leaders of the Republicans. I think it's more difficult for the Republican leadership to push back against it. I think what we see right now is an attempt by President Trump to derail all that and change the agenda to another issue. Now, I have to note, if you look at General Clapper's statement It was very carefully phrased. I mean, so he said no FISA court order of this type of the Trump Tower. And I think that there is something in the background that the media is so far not doing a good job of reporting and covering. And there is a FISA court order. But to be clear, it's not an order that directed tapping of Trump Tower or Donald Trump. Rather, it's an order that was issued on October 15th, has not been reported in the U.S. media, has been reported in Europe more extensively. And it's in connection with a counterintelligence investigation that's been going on since last summer that targets not Donald Trump, but five individuals who have or at one point did play some role in his campaign and their dealings with people who are suspected to be Russian intelligence operatives.
Tell us more about that.
Well, we don't know much about it because the entire process surrounding FISA court proceedings is secret. But when you see
the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act Court.
And you know, to obtain that order, a judge had to review an application that justified it and had to find that there was probable cause to issue the order. Now, all the judges of the FISA court are Republicans. In fact, they're all selected by Chief Justice Roberts, and they're all people very much like him. So for a FISA judge to have authorized this is quite something. I think we saw Lindsey Graham hinting at that in the past. And when we see reports previously about intercepts of communications and what they may or may not said, that's all coming out of this investigation.
Well, Bob Perry, you've written that there is no there in this issue of all of the hullabaloo that we've seen in the press over Russia and Trump. Could you expound on that and give us your take?
Well, I'm not sure there's no there. What I'm saying is that so far, the Obama administration, and as far as we know, what's happened since then with some of the holdovers from the Obama administration, they've not presented the real evidence to show that there was this effort by the Russians to leak this material or hack this material and provide it to WikiLeaks. WikiLeaks has flatly denied that they received this information from the Russians. They've indicated there were apparently two American insiders who they believe would have been the sources of this information. So what you've got is a lot of ifs going on, not just the ifs that President Trump has put out through his tweets, but also now there's also a lot of ifs about what happened initially. So we have a situation where Washington has kind of gone nuts, where there hasn't been the kind of evidence presented on anyone's part that convinces me or a lot of other people that have looked at this, including former people from the National Security Agency, people like William Binney. So you have problems here where the evidence is not supporting, at least to this point, a lot of these allegations. We've had a lot of suspicions and a lot of smoke, but so far not much in the way of fire.
And you've also raised that Russia is increasingly being made the boogeyman, not only by those on the right, but many on the left who were either supporters of President Obama or were progressives who ended up supporting Hillary Clinton, that you feel that there's an unnecessary heating up of a new Cold War.
Well, there's no question. We're now into a new Cold War, and we're also seeing kind of a new McCarthyism. What you've seen is a very hostile approach that the United States has taken toward Russia, going back really to the Ukraine crisis, and it has been escalating. And the Russians have responded somewhat in kind. So you had a much more cooperative relationship between President Obama and President Putin that preceded the 2014 Ukraine crisis. They worked together on the Syrian crisis. It was Putin who got Assad to give up his chemical weapons. They worked together on Iran, getting Iran to constrain its nuclear program. But then with the crisis in Ukraine, which was not simply a case that involved some American input to try to create that as a turning point in how this whole relationship developed. So we've had this narrative set up that the Russians are made into the bad guys. And that has now continued on into the campaign, now into the new presidency.
Scott Horton, your thoughts on the allegations of Russian hacking of the election and Russia's involvement with Donald Trump and his associates, even if we're talking about oligarchs helping to finance Donald Trump's development projects because it was hard for him to get lines of credit since he had gone bankrupt so many times.
Well, I think just the hacking and release of information all on its own is actually relatively little, not so much a big deal. In fact, assuming the Russians do it, and I think the evidence, unlike my colleague, I think the evidence is very convincing that they did, it's not a big deal. It's what intelligence services do all over the world. What would make this a far bigger matter is if there were collusion between the Trump campaign and Russians throughout the process, if the hacking were requested, if it were being guided by them, and then if beyond that it were to turn out that the Russians, in fact, financed Donald Trump to the tune of hundreds of millions of dollars, as indeed his son acknowledged in the press statement before the campaign got going.
What do you mean?
That is that if you look at Trump's situation after the bankruptcies that occurred in 2004 when the banks withdrew their letters of credit, most people thought he was finished. From that point forward, there was an infusion of hundreds of millions of dollars into Trump projects, Trump-branded projects all around the world that refloated the Trump empire and made it viable. All that money seems to have come out of Russia from Russian oligarchs and Russian organized crime groups. And that's something that was really not very well developed during the campaign. And those facts altogether would explain what is otherwise an almost inexplicable relationship between Donald Trump and Putin, where he cannot criticize this man or say a negative thing about him.
Well, Bob Perry, you're famed for your investigative reports, and you said that, unfortunately, with in journalism today, there's a lack of real investigative reporting. It's basically who can get the first leaks from which branch of which intelligence agency in the government. What do you think is lacking in terms of the kinds of investigations that journalists should be using? What about this whole issue of the long-term economic relationships that may have existed between Trump and Russian oligarchs?
Well, again, there are a lot of ifs here, and I don't think there's been any hard evidence presented on these things either. There was this reference from The Sun, who was apparently talking about some of these Russian oligarchs buying up Trump condos and other kind of properties, but that doesn't mean it was coming from the Russian government. This idea that everything in Russia is controlled at the top is not really true. It's a large country like ours is, and there are many different factors and factions that operate. So to pretend that we all know this is somewhat misleading, and there's a huge amount of this whole question of if we're at a very dangerous point here, where there's a real possibility of a crisis between the United States and Russia, and instead of anything that's been very serious or hard in terms of evidence, we've been dealing with suppositions. As Scott says, even if the Russians did somehow get this information to WikiLeaks, the information itself was all accurate. It dealt with things that were relatively significant in terms of what we would know about how the Clinton campaign was operating. But it was not decisive in any way to the election. Hillary Clinton herself blamed James Comey for his reopening of her investigation into her email situation as the principal cause for her defeat. It wasn't the Russians.
Scott Horton.
Well, I think any election in which the man who was second past the post wins and is installed in president, and a shift of 40,000 votes would have dramatically affected the outcome. Any of a number of hundreds of things could have caused a change in the election. I think what we've seen here, and I agree with Bob Perry on this, is a really dramatic failure of inquiry by the press during the election, failure to develop a number of really important issues relating to Trump and the Trump campaign. But there's no reason not to fully explore and develop them right now. And I think, in the end, if everything goes in the direction I think it's going to go, this would be the end of the Trump presidency.
And you've also said, haven't you, that you would agree with Bob Perry on the general outlines of the criticism of the U.S. policy toward Russia, that there's been much more aggressive posture by the United States and interfering in affairs close to the Russian borders.
Yes, I agree. So, I mean, I think the U.S. made grave mistakes in the way it expanded NATO into the region and the way it interacted with Georgia, for instance, before the war in 2008. But that's another another set of questions. And I think the confrontation we're looking at from Russia today is not the old Cold War kind of confrontation with nuclear weapons and armored divisions. It's it is a very aggressive policy of intervention and engagement in Western politics and Western elections, not just in the United States. It's going on today in France and Italy and Germany, and following the same shadow, the same profile in almost every single country.
We're going to continue this conversation and then post online at democracynow.org. Scott Horton teaches at Columbia Law School, writes for Harper's Magazine, and Bob Perry writes for Consortium News, and we'll link to his news there. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez with part two of our conversation with Bob Perry and Scott Horton. Juan?
Well, the ongoing mystery of Russia's role in the 2016 U.S. presidential election took an unexpected turn early Saturday morning when President Trump accused former President Obama of wiretapping Trump Tower. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting FBI Director James Comey has asked the Justice Department to publicly reject Trump's assertion.
To make sense of what's happening, we're continuing our conversation with attorney Scott Horton, who's a lecturer at Columbia Law School, a contributing editor at Harper's Magazine, and Robert Perry, veteran investigative journalist and editor of the website ConsortiumNews.com, his latest article, The Politics Behind Russiagate. Clearly, this weekend, President Trump lost it at every level. You see the telephoto lens showing what's going on in the Oval Office. He leaves to go to Florida without Bannon and Priebus, and then Bannon follows soon after. The anger there, apparently, was when he learned that Attorney General Sessions said he would recuse himself from any investigation into Trump-Russia connections during the campaign, since he was a part of the campaign. Your thoughts, Robert Perry, on what's happening at this point, and whether you do think there should be an independent investigation?
Well, there probably should be some sort of investigation to clear up all this mystery and all these allegations. But there still hasn't been the kind of evidence that I would expect to see before something like that happens. When I was doing investigations into things like the Contra drug trafficking or what became Iran-Contra, the issues of the 1980 election, the 68 election, we had a great deal of hard evidence that something had actually happened. There were contacts between, say, the Nixon administration or the Nixon campaign and the South Vietnamese in 68. Similarly, with Reagan's campaign and some of the Iranians in 1980, in the Contra drug case, we had dozens of sources at that point. So at this point, we just don't have that kind of information. And so a lot of this has been based on claims by the U.S. intelligence community, which has not been willing to present any evidence to support their charges about the Russians' effort to interfere in the election. We've had these two reports that have been put out. I've read both of them. They are laughably insufficient in terms of presenting any evidence. So you have this problem where we're working from very much a questionable basis or pretext for this investigation, and then so much has been built off of that, now to the point of President Trump losing control and sending out this tweet storm early in the morning to try to claim that no, the real problem was Obama was wiretapping him. So we've had all this very, very dangerous disorder and confusion in Washington around something as sensitive as the relationship with Russia, a nuclear-armed country, which is looking at us in a very strange way at this point. They've also, by the way, been denying that they were trying to do some of these things. Now, maybe they're lying, and of course, that's always possible, but we've seen very little hard evidence.
Now, what about the whole issue of Jeff Sessions recusing himself over his misstatements to a Senate committee? Do you see any problems there, or again, is this more smoke than actual fire?
Well, clearly he was not clear what he was saying. Now, I don't know what exactly happened, but the idea that he was having a meeting with the Russian ambassador in his Senate office with two Senate aides there, and they were somehow colluding to see how Russia could help the Trump campaign win the election is a little hard to buy at this point. You also have the situation with the issue that when did these leaks occur? When was the information sent to WikiLeaks? Supposedly, the meeting between Sessions and the Russian ambassador occurred in September. So WikiLeaks already had this information. Both batches were in their possession by then. So it's not clear what we're getting at here. Sessions clearly wasn't entirely precise in what he was saying, but I think he was talking about the issue of did he or others collude with the Russians on the campaign, in which case he may have been accurately denying that, but not mentioning that he actually met with the Russian ambassador.
So, Scott Horton, what do you think is the case that convinces you that Russia was involved?
I think the evidence of collusion actually is astonishingly strong already, and that's without intelligence or transcripts or even specific detail about communications that have occurred. And that goes back to what happened at the Republican convention in Cleveland. So we know that Kislyak, the Russian ambassador, was there. We know there were a series of meetings with him with a number of senior aides and advisors of Trump. And we know that hours after the last of those meetings occurred, there was a bit of legerdemain in the platform committee with a change of a provision of the Republican platform that condemned Russia and supported hard arming of Russia. All this was changed with no explanation and without the members of the platform committee themselves even understanding why, simply because Donald Trump wanted this to happen. And to suggest that that's completely innocent in the discussions with the Russian ambassador had nothing to do with it, I think, is pretty gullible.
But would that really? But would that not? I mean, yeah. Go ahead. But that's not accurate. The point is that Trump had made clear that he was opposed to the idea of arming the Ukrainian military to fight the Russians quite much earlier. This was not some surprise thing that just came up.
No, it was a surprise thing that just came up, because if you looked at what was in the platform contained those condemnations, and it was changed, and it was changed right after those consultations. But, of course, you did have Donald Trump, in fact, in the course of the campaign, making three specific concessions to the Russians, which were pulling back on sanctions, moving away from a support of the government in Kiev and recognizing Russian annexation of Crimea. Now, these are exactly the three things that we know from the correspondence that occurred between the Russians and the Front National in France, that the Russian government demanded of the Front National in connection with its funding of Front National activities, ditto with the Five Star Coalition in Italy. So the big question is, was there a bargain for exchange, and what was the tit for tat that occurred?
Yes, but there's no evidence that there was. I mean, again, this is speculation. You can sort of point to certain things where people were met with people. The Russian ambassador met with lots of people. He met with Senator Feinstein. He met with was not an unusual thing for the Russian ambassador to be presenting the case on behalf of his government with American political leaders. That's kind of what ambassadors do.
Well, you had the chain. Go ahead.
And there's no evidence that there was a quid pro quo. We're at a very advanced stage here, and unlike other investigations that I've been involved with, where there was really hard evidence, we had witnesses inside telling us things about how things had occurred. Here we don't. We just have people saying, well, there was a meeting, and we kind of speculate that maybe something happened.
You just had J.D. Gordon, who was the Trump campaign national security policy representative at the RNC, going on television and saying, yeah, he had this information inserted for his boss. He was talking about Donald Trump.
Okay. All right. So, but Trump was not surprising that Trump was not interested in escalating the crisis with Russia over Ukraine. He said that publicly, repeatedly, and frankly, to his political detriment. He wasn't really making a lot of it wasn't a really super popular thing to be taking that position, at least certainly not in the Washington world. How it played out around the country perhaps is a bit different, but this was not some kind of reversal of Trump's positions relating to Ukraine and Russia.
Well, Scott, I want to ask you about that, because you're saying that there's clear evidence of collusion. But what there is clear evidence, appears to me, is that the Russian ambassador was lobbying strongly with the Republicans to make sure that they got into their platform the kinds of issues that he was concerned about. That doesn't necessarily mean that there was collusion to somehow or other affect the U.S. elections, right? I mean, that all that shows is that he was lobbying fiercely and that he had some success, and that Trump already, as Bob says, was supportive of a lot of the positions of the Russian ambassador.
Yes. The question is, was there a quid pro quo? Because
right.
we have, you know, from the DNI report, we have evidence that they've collected, which it's true they haven't shown us all of their sourcing for everything, and I wish they would show more. I think it would be appropriate for them to do so. Nevertheless, they've made these conclusions. 16, 17 different U.S. intelligence agencies have come to the same conclusion. An extraordinary set of active measures being taken by the Russians to influence the elections to support one particular candidate. And the question is, were there concessions being made by that candidate in exchange for that support? And I think when we look at the positions that are taken by Trump, actions like this change of the platform, there is definitely sufficient evidence on the surface to warrant a deeper investigation of what went on, and that should be going on.
And Bob Perry, wouldn't you agree that the issue of Trump's financial, his tax forms and his financial records would help to possibly clear up any cloud that would exist over whether he was in some way or other either receiving financial backing from banks that might have been close to the leaders of Russia or direct support in one way or another from Russia?
Well, of course, I always support the idea that politicians should be as transparent as possible in terms of their finances and anything else. But that's a bit of a different question. So we don't know what one might find, but that doesn't mean you make allegations and make assumptions without evidence. And that's what I've been seeing happening here. And it's been very dangerous. And now we're seeing Trump kind of doing the same thing. He's out making his own allegations based apparently on nothing very, very strong, at least. Maybe his suspicions. He said a lot of ifs here. So again, what we've seen is a kind of a meltdown of serious behavior on the part of in Washington, on the part of the mainstream media, on the part of the Congress, on the part of the executive, and both administrations, really. I think President Obama went pretty far in trying to push this argument. And whether he did it from out of conviction or out of political animosity toward Trump might also be an interesting question to pursue. He obviously has very strong feelings against President Trump. So when he went out and started spreading this information around in ways that we've never seen before, he made an effort, so as the New York Times reported, so that this record would be there for lots of people to have access to. This is not how it's usually done. And certainly in the situation with National Security Advisor Flynn, the idea that his identity was put into this intercept with the Russian ambassador is quite extraordinary. American citizens are supposed to be protected in those cases, as Scott fully knows. So you have a lot of transgressions here in pursuit of an issue that where there's been very little core, fundamental, foundational evidence presented.
Well, what
and that's
about
why I think. And when Scott says that the DNI and the CIA should have put out more information at the end of the Obama administration, yes, but they put out almost nothing. I read those two reports, and you should go through them. They are laughable in terms of any kind of evidence. And there's no reason why that should not have been presented at the beginning of this, not at this stage. We don't even know what the situation is even now.
Scott Horton.
Well, I don't think those reports are laughable. In fact, I think they're persuasive, but I wish they would put out more evidence. So I think we have a long way to go on this. But I would also say on the financial side and the flow of money is really the much bigger story than the hacking and the issues surrounding the hacking. And on that, there's been actually—
And some of the reports are that the FISA order was in relationship to two Russian banks,
precisely,
right?
Precisely. It's Vanishtorg Bank and Alpha Bank are mentioned in the FISA court order. And this was issued by a Republican judge, so there had to have been a showing of probable cause to get that order. That's a significant fact.
Well, Scott, as you know, the FISA court almost never rejects a request.
Well, here, of course, as you know, they rejected three requests. So it's not the case that they never. But there was there was a finding, and I think that's in a highly political case with a Republican judge giving it. So there's quite something there, but we don't know what it is. I think that's true. But it does focus on financial dealings and the flow of cash. That's a huge point that was underdeveloped. But again, I would say on this issue, the flow of money, not just acknowledged by the Trump campaign when they were trying to tout their own horn in 2006, 2007, later 2012, but also documented in great degree by the Financial Times, which did the story of three major stories looking at the financing of major projects and found these projects were funded almost entirely by money coming from Russian oligarchs and mobsters who were buying large blocks of condominium units and not using them, not residing in them, just so it was a way of paying massive sums of money to Trump.
Bob Perry mentioned that even if the oligarchs were supporting Donald Trump and giving him tens of millions of dollars, as we know with projects like Trump Soho, the building downtown here in New York City, that doesn't necessarily connect him to the Russian government. So you have different thoughts on this.
I definitely disagree. I mean, I would have said the same thing before 2000. After the rise of Putin and after his reining in of the oligarchs, that's not the case. Oligarchs and what they do, and particularly what they do abroad, are highly constrained by the Russian government. There are also very complex capital outflow restrictions in Russia today. It's difficult to get your money out of the country and put it in projects like these. But I think what we found is that Russian oligarchs and others had no problem moving their money offshore when it went into projects that were controlled by Donald Trump. That had a green light from the government. And we have things like Dmitry Rublev, the potash king of Russia, who purchases a strip of property next to Mar-a-Lago, paying twice its market value. I mean, that was just putting $100 million straight into Trump's pocket. Why?
Why was it doing that? It was his property?
It was Trump's property. He purchased it from Trump. He paid twice the market value for it, $100 million, $95 million to be exact, for it. And that had the blessing of the Kremlin. You can count on it.
Bob Perry, are these warning signs to you?
Well, I mean, when a lot of this happened, Trump was not expected to become president of the United States. There was the idea that this was all sort of some grand scheme to put Trump in the White House really goes against all logic. Nobody thought, and I can go back and quote every major journalist pretty much in Washington. No one thought Trump was going to win the Republican nomination, let alone the election.
Well, at that time, what if it wasn't any grand scheme? It was just he was in debt to the Russian oligarchs. And now, given what has happened, that they have something on him.
Well, I guess a lot of things are possible. There are a lot of things. Maybe it is possible that Obama did wiretap the Trump Tower, but we have no reason to believe it happened. There needs to be something like called evidence. Mm-hmm. And right now that's lacking.
Who do you think would best investigate it, Bob Perry?
Well, Amy, I've lost faith a lot in government investigations over the years. And I'm sure maybe you feel the same. I've seen government investigations that are pretty good and a lot that are pretty terrible. And often they're very politicized, one way or another, to shut down something or to exaggerate something. So I'm not sure who would be the best to investigate it, but I would tell you that whatever comes out, it would still be worth seriously examining from the point of view of journalists who try to be objective and honest about these things, whether or not some report comes out whitewashing it or exaggerating it. It still deserves a set of eyes where you look at things very carefully. So, but I really don't think there is in Washington any wise man or any wise woman or some institution that you can count on. It doesn't exist anymore in Washington. Maybe it did in some earlier time, but not anymore.
And Scott Horton, who do you think should be investigating it?
Yeah, you shouldn't be relying on one single source to do it. I mean, our society works as a robust dialogue and discussion in which many parties are engaged in the process of probing and looking at it. And that's how we come closest to the truth. That's the formula that's been used throughout American history. So I really think the counterintelligence / DOJ investigation should continue. And there needs to be an independent counsel who's running it. I mean, a credible leader of that investigation. I think Congress has got to be involved in the probe. And I think the press has got to work on it and has to work on it much more seriously seriously than it has in the past, because throughout the election, we saw, you know, bright, glittery things on the surface were picked up and discussed ad nauseum, but there was relatively little serious investigative journalism. Now, that all being said, I think we're in territory which is particularly difficult to investigate, because we're dealing with a covert operation of a foreign power, which may be down in its luck in many areas, but is still really very professional and effective in this one. And getting past all of the protections they put in place to understand what really happened is an extremely difficult proposition. And collecting information, particularly over on the home turf in Russia, in Ukraine, and in that neighborhood, is extremely difficult to do.
The heads of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees have already said there's no evidence there. Interestingly enough, James Clapper also said there's no evidence there yesterday, when he was also saying there wasn't a FISA court warrant. James Clapper, of course, just a few years ago lying to Ron Wyden when he was before him being questioned about whether Americans are being spied on.
Well, of course, the House and Senate Intelligence Committees haven't called a single witness or examined a single document, so it's easy to say there isn't any evidence. If you don't look at the evidence, there isn't any evidence. With respect to General Clapper, statement. My understanding is, you know, he knows what's happened in certain respects with this counterintelligence investigation, but not everything. But one of the problems is that they pick up incidents of communication, but they don't have information about the substance of the communication. That's part of the problem with our entire system of intercepts. So he can't say that these communications were collusion in connection with leaks or anything like that. They only know that there were communications.
Well, we're going to leave it there. I want to thank you both for being with us. Scott Horton, Columbia Law School and Harper's, Robert Perry, Consortium News. And we'll link to both of your work. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks so much for joining us.